You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, November 26, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. I am still full from that Thanksgiving meal.
Still?
Yeah.
I really overdid it this year.
In the past few days, I've had four meals consisting of just meatball lasagna. It's awesome.
But what happened on this date in history, Rebecca?
On December 1st, 1948, a grand mystery began based upon the death of a man whose name is still unknown. As you guys know, I'm flying to Australia tomorrow to go to a conference in Melbourne. And so in honor of that, I wanted to do a This Day in Skeptic History that has an Australian bent. So this is a really interesting case. It's called the Taman Shud case, or the Mystery of the Somerton Man. So on December 1st, 1948, the body of a man was discovered on a beach in Adelaide, Australia. And the man was well dressed. He was wearing a suit, but no hat, which was odd for the time, apparently. And nobody knew who he was. His dental records were non-existent. He had no distinguishing characteristics, really. There was no ID on him. So nobody could figure out who this guy was. Eventually he was connected with a suitcase. They found a suitcase that they realized was his because there was a thread in it that was very rare and matched stitching on the inside of this man's pants. So they figured that this must be his suitcase, but there was really nothing in there to give away any clues either. But the weirdest thing was that they found sewn into one of his pockets, they found the torn off page from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. It's a famous book of poems, basically. And this man had in his pocket a little bit of paper that had been torn off, and all it said on the paper was Tamam Shud. I think I'm pronouncing that horribly wrong. But that's what it said. And the officials realized that that was that meant ended or finished. And it was, at the end of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, this collection of poems. And so specifically, it had been torn out. They realized it had been torn out of that book, a very specific edition of that book that didn't have any writing on the other side of the page. And they couldn't find any editions that were printed like that. All of the editions that they found had printing on both sides of the page where those words were. Until this guy came forward, he realized that it hadn't occurred to him originally that this was connected to this unsolved mystery. But the night that the dead man apparently died, someone had placed a copy of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam in the backseat of his unlocked car that was parked nearby. And sure enough, in the back, they found that that piece of paper had been torn out of that book. And in the book was a code. There were these seemingly random letters written in the back, but they look like a code. And nobody's been able to crack the code yet. Still nobody knows who this guy is. There have been a lot of people guessing that this is something to do with the Cold War, that he was a spy. There's also this other connection where there was a child who died mysteriously and was somehow connected with this guy because they both share similar genetics, or not genetics. They both share similar medical oddities in their bodies that feel that there's so much. It's something weird about their ears. One of the things they both have, like, one part of their ear is longer than the other.
Simba was bigger than his cavum.
Yes, that's what it is.
Characteristic of 1-2% of the Caucasian population. He also had attached rather than hanging earlobes, which is also a less common variation.
Right. And there was one other, hypodontia, some sort of, thing with his incisors. That's only present in 2% of the population, and both the kid and this guy had it. And both died mysteriously. Like, they're not really sure how they died. The coroner thought that this guy was poisoned, but he has no, the poison didn't leave any trace, so they don't have any proof of that. So it's this huge mystery that still hasn't been solved. There are researchers that are now asking if they can exhume the body so that they can test the DNA in order to figure out at least like the general area that this guy, like the country maybe that this guy came from. But apparently last year, Attorney General John Rao wouldn't let them exhume the body because he says there needs to be public interest reasons that go well beyond public curiosity or broad scientific interest, which is bogus. What's wrong with broad scientific interest? Dig that body up. That's what I say. Cause it's a really interesting case. Like, you know, it's got everything that a good Hollywood thriller has, you know, except for the ending. It needs an ending. So. I thought that was really interesting. I had never heard of it before, so.
And you're heading to Australia to figure it all out.
I'm gonna break this one wide open.
Awesome.
I'm gonna solve this case.
Well, Jay, you're gonna tell us about a mystery that perhaps has recently been solved in involving a very large bird.
So, starting on January 5th, 2009, a Pineapple Express storm hit the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Does everybody know where the Pineapple Express is?
No.
Comes from Hawaii?
It's a movie.
Yeah, that was a good guess, Steve. These types of storms come from the subtropical Pacific and are dangerous because of the huge quantities of water that they dump. So without going into the details.
And all the pineapples flying all over the place.
Yeah, read about it. I've never heard about it. It's the name is for a storm that starts in the Pacific Northwest and then, I guess, hits, the United States. But if you're interested, read more about that. But I had some fun reading about that. Never heard about a Pineapple Express before. So, like I said, these storms pick up and dump an enormous amount of water. And this storm that I'm talking about that happened in 2009 hit the deeply snow-covered foothills of Whatcom County in Washington, which is a state in the United States. And it delivered an incredibly huge deluge of rain and warm temperatured water. The storm resulted in massive water accumulation in the snow that was already there, and it ended up causing significant landslides. However, the good news is that those landslides uncovered something really awesome. A study published in the journal Paleontology studied a set of footprints made 55.8 to 48.6 million years ago, and the footprints are preserved in sandstone and are believed to be none other than the long-extinct giant bird known as Diatryma. And, Steve, I figured you really like this news item for a number of reasons, because you love dinosaurs and because you love birds.
That's redundant. But yeah.
Well, yeah.
Well, when I say birds, I mean modern birds, okay?
Modern-day really? Dinosaurs. Avids.
So that every time I make that distinction, somebody says, you mean non-avian dinosaurs. You know, that.
No.
No, whenever I say dinosaurs and I'm referring to non-avian dinosaurs, somebody pedantically corrects me. And says, you know, you mean non-avian dinosaurs. You know, the thing is, like, if you're using the term dinosaur, this is going to come up later in the show, too. If you're using the term dinosaur colloquially, people know what the hell you're talking about. You're talking about dinosaurs, you know, non-avian dinosaurs, not birds. While birds are in the dinosaur clade, you know, I don't think anybody thinks of a sparrow as a dinosaur.
I agree.
And
I'll continue my news item now.
It's the first thing that comes to mind when somebody says dinosaur, I think of a sparrow.
Sparrow.
Jack Sparrow.
Diatryma were giant flightless birds found as fossils in early Eocene rocks in North America and in Europe. The Eocene epoch lasted 57.8 to 36.6 million years ago. So these monsters grew to a height of about 2.25 meters or 7 feet. It's a pretty big bird. It had small flightless wings and incredibly powerful legs, most likely used for running. And it had a large head and an equally powerful beak. This big, nasty beak. Because of the beak, it's been previously thought that these guys were predators eating small mammals. George Musto, a geologist and team member studying the footprints, said they are commonly thought as the bird that replaced dinosaurs as the top predator. But now that those footprints exist, they provide some evidence about what the birds ate, and we're going to see a shift here. And this is the way that science works. When new evidence presents itself, science's opinion or facts change on that subject. David Tucker, another researcher on the study, said the tracks clearly show that the animals did not have long talons, but rather short toenails. And this argues against an animal that catches prey and uses claws to hold it down. Carnivore birds all have sharp, long talons. That's a huge point. They were able to see that these birds didn't have the equipment to actually be flesh catchers and flesh eaters, which is significant here. Some early paleontologists concluded that because the diatryma was big and with a huge head and beak, it must have been a predator. But the first fossil they ever found was next to tiny horses and small animals, and that kind of led to that premise, and they just figured that those were its dead prey, which I thought was funny that, like, you know, this bird died next to its recent prey, which, you know, maybe there was a big battle they thought or whatever, but it's still kind of weird to think that they'd find the skeletal remains of a deadly predator right next to, like, three or four animals it just happened to be eating right before it died.
Oh, I don't know, Jay. They'll probably find you, you know, amidst, like, a giant table of bacon.
Or meatballs. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So other scientists at the same time suggested that because their legs were short, they could not run fast enough to capture small prey, and they did not have a hook beak, and that's huge, which is always found on raptors to help them tear flesh, leading them to think that they were herbivores. So even back in the day, there wasn't a total consensus on what the nature of these animals actually was. The fact that diatryma did not have talons added greatly to the idea that they were herbivores. Mr. Musto added a more likely scenario than being a carnivore would be a gentle diatryma that used its beak to harvest foliage, fruits, seeds, and subtropical forests that it inhabited.
Did you say foliage?
Foliage
is what you wrap the foliage in for leftovers.
Yeah.
Foliage. Did I say foliage?
You said foliage.
I meant foliage.
Well, we know what you meant, yes.
You guys are like ridiculous pen dance tonight.
Yeah.
All right. The team believes that the similarities of diatryma to those of the carnivorous South American forostasids
Forest Racidae.
I was going to say forest monkey.
A.K.A. terror birds. For real. They call these guys terror birds.
They are my favorite extinct birds.
Look at those pictures.
They are magnificent.
Yeah, they're
my God.
Terrifying.
So those guys led early paleontologists to assume that the two were ecologically similar. And what have we learned, guys?
That you can't pronounce words.
Yeah, I can't pronounce words that are spelled very strangely that I've only read and never said. Absolutely.
What's one thing that's interesting, because when I first read the article, it said terror birds, like, not so terrifying. I'm like, really? Really? Like, how did they're changing our understanding of the terror birds? But they're just essentially saying that this North American cousin was an herbivore and was not similar to the South American terror birds, which have a Titanus walleri is one example. They had a curved beak like a hawk. They had talons like a raptor. And they had long legs for running, most of them.
And they were about, what, 10 feet tall, Steve?
9 feet, yeah, 9 feet. So they were bigger.
Impressive.
But there were like 18, I think, different species, and they varied in height and characteristics. Some had shorter legs, some had longer legs, but some of them, like Titanus, had all the characteristics they're saying are typical of a carnivore. Curved beak, talons, long legs for running. These same bird, a little bit smaller, but no curved beak, no talons, shorter legs. But otherwise, the same basic body plan. And one thing that was interesting, too, they were talking about the fact that the body plan is very similar to a T-Rex. Large head, small arms, large legs. Same basic kind of configuration. Yeah, it's basically an avian T-Rex.
And the T-Rex is also being neutered, of course. Like, every time we get more information about the T-Rex, it becomes less terrible, too.
Being that, it would be really cool if these guys were herbivores and some existed today, because you might be able to ride them.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Steve, did you hear this? I read that the terror birds primarily existed in South America, but and they did, I think, for something like millions of years. They were like on top of the food chain for quite a long time. And I remember reading somewhere that they also, when South America joined North America, you know, Central America, when they actually joined together, when a land bridge was first formed, they actually, I think if I'm remembering correctly, they migrated into North America and existed there for a little while, not very long,
yeah,
but for a little while they were actually in North America.
That's correct. Their remains have been found in Texas and Florida. But they did not survive long with the mixing of fauna in North and South America.
Yeah.
But on both sides, they were victims of that exchange. But yeah, but they did make it into the southern part of North America. Thanks, Jay. That's interesting. I always love talking about dinosaurs and birds. But Rebecca, you're going to, this is a yet another this is the mystery theme for this evening. So you gave us a mystery. We sort of solved the mystery about the nature of the North American large flightless birds. And now there's another deep skeptical mystery that we've talked about on this show before that has been solved.
Yeah. And, you know, to get back to the initial dead guy in Australia mystery, if that guy turns out to be just some guy who dropped out of a heart attack or something, it ended up not being a very cool story at all. If that were the case, then it would fit in perfectly with tonight's mysteries, because this is another mystery that has been solved in a way that is not particularly fun. Like, the mystery itself, lots of fun. The scientific explanation, I feel...
boring.
Not that much fun. Yeah. So
I like it, but go ahead.
Well, that's because you're super...
So you can stop right there. Okay.
So yes, we have in the past discussed the bloop, the bloop noise, that seemed to emanate somewhere from, the ocean. It was recorded by several different deep sea microphones back in 97. And, if you haven't heard the bloop,
Let's play it for our listeners right now.
Okay.
That was sped up 16 times, by the way. It's when it's at normal speed, you can barely hear it.
Yeah, it doesn't really sound like anything at all when it's normal speed. But yeah, so you can tell why it is called the bloop. And, you know, for years, people have wondered what the hell is that, including scientists. They weren't really sure. They noticed that it sounded kind of like a living creature. That it, you know, the way that the sound is made, the, you know, how it sounds like it's being made by a creature. And because it's so loud, like it was incredibly loud, and it was something that had never been recorded before, never been heard before, they speculated that it could be something like a giant squid, like a really, really, really giant squid living somewhere.
Like, you know, larger than the blue whale squid.
Yeah, somewhere undetected, you know. So it was pretty exciting and scary to know that there was something, there's a possibility there's some enormous creature lurking somewhere in the ocean that we haven't even heard of yet, we haven't even found yet. Well, it's not. So the recent discovery, according to Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, the bloop is in fact an ice quake. The name sounds cool, but trust me, not as cool as a giant squid would have been.
Quite cold. Sorry.
Anyway.
Oh, God.
Yes. So scientists found that
I'm amused.
The bloop is in fact consistent with the sounds that icebergs make as they crack and fracture. They've used microphones to record a number of these ice quakes since 1997. And they have found that the bloop fits it perfectly, in terms of loudness, what the waveforms look like, what it sounds like.
And the sound travels far. We're talking thousands of kilometers.
Yeah, because, I mean, the bloop was picked up by microphones that were 3,000 miles apart. So, yeah, this fits in with that as well. Because, yeah, the sound can travel. So... yeah, it's just stupid global warming. That's all. Ooh.
It's what the sound of a dying planet sounds like.
Yeah.
Bloop.
That was cool. It's like, you know, an iceberg cracking up and it makes that low frequency noise. It's really
not as cool as a kraken.
Yeah, but no one ever kraken. Who really thought it was going to be some kind of kraken?
I thought it was going to be a kraken. Oh. I had hope.
Like you were hoping that it was going to go along the lines of Cthulhu.
Yeah,
right?
Because, I was hoping for the end of all things.
That would be so terrifying. Yeah, have you ever been on a boat and you just imagine some gigantic kraken coming out of the water? It's that those really big things hiding under the ocean just freak me out. That's too scary.
Ditto. That's why I love it. I love the idea of it. Yeah. And I hate the scientists who have ripped this from my dreams.
Yeah, they've ruined it.
Mm-hmm. Stupid science with your facts.
With your facts.
Rebecca, there's plenty of stuff in science to dream about. I'll talk to you later about it.
Better be scary.
So have something to do with zombies, I'm sure.
So we're going to shift from mysteries to a couple of DNA-related news items, starting with Bob, who's going to tell us about DNA hijacking.
Yeah, thanks to Melissa G, who sent me a link to a great article about a creature that is now in my top three list of cool animals. They are tiny invertebrate organisms. They're called Deloid rotifers, which I don't like their name because it begins with a B, yet I believe it's pronounced Deloid rotifers. And there's a new genetic analysis out that shows that 10% of their active genes were hijacked from at least 500 other species. These genes were taken from creatures like fungi, bacteria, and plants. And so they're just all over the taking whatever they need or want. And
like shopping in the grocery store.
Yeah, right.
I'll go to this aisle and take some of that.
And these, as you can imagine, when you could have if you could choose pretty much any genes you want in a sense, it gives them pretty amazing abilities, unlike any other animals. And it has also allowed them to survive millions of years longer than evolutionary theory says that they otherwise probably would have. It's a fascinating story. So what are their superpowers is probably one of the first things you're interested in. They could actually survive incredible doses of ionizing radiation so high that doses 100 times less or 1/100th would be enough to take out even the hardiest human. They can also be desiccated or completely dried out for at least 9 years. I believe 9 years is the record. And then they come back in a matter of hours. They come back pretty much like nothing's happened.
Wow.
And for example, they've got two genes that they stole from bacteria that produce enzymes that can break down highly toxic chemicals like benzyl cyanide. So these are pretty interesting abilities that these guys just totally just grabbed from other species. The other amazing thing about them is that scientists have never found a male Deloid. They've looked for a long time. They've never come across a male.
They're all chicks. Huh?
They're all females. In fact,
they don't need male ones apparently.
They don't, not at all. They've been asexual for 80 million years. And now that's a long, long time not to have sex. I don't think I could survive half that long. Asexual reproduction may not, you hear about that all the time. It may not sound like a big deal. And it's true for lots of different creatures like bacteria, of course. But these rotifers, though, are one of the only groups of animals to 100% abandon sex. They reproduce through parthenogenesis, which means that the embryos grow and develop without the aid of any fertilization or anything. This, as a quick aside, I found this interesting. This is related to another form of asexual reproduction. Steve, have you heard of gynogenesis or pseudogamy? This method, it actually uses sperm or pollen to trigger the development of the egg cell into an embryo, but there's no genetic contribution at all. It just starts the process and then says goodbye, and there's no genetic addition at all or contribution, which I found interesting. That's gynogenesis. I never heard of that one. So what makes the rotifer form of reproduction unusual is that 100% asexual animals shouldn't really last 80 million years. According to the, modern evolutionary theory, if you just looked at that information as it is, you would say that 80 million years just seems like an awfully long time for a creature or a species to last, because obviously there's no genetic shuffling, there's no genetic variation that allows a species to rapidly adapt to an ever-changing environment, and also the effects of maladaptive genes as well. So this, of course, may yet be another benefit of this genetic hijacking. Being able to co-opt genes from other species not only gave them their cool superpowers, but it's also helped them live for tens of millions of years and diversify into, I think, hundreds, 300 or 400 different distinct species. I love the term scientists have given them. They call them genetic mosaics, which I think is really beautifully descriptive. So then the next question, of course, is how do they pull this off? Scientists aren't 100% sure, but one theory I read about seems to pretty much describe what I think is probably happening, or at least hopefully happening, because this is a really fascinating process. And it's all related to desiccation. When these guys get all dried out and they enter into their dormant state, it's called hydrobiosis. When they emerge from this process, they go through a genetic transformation of sorts that, as far as I can tell, is unique in the animal kingdom. Desiccation, as you can imagine, breaks cell membranes and breaks apart the DNA. I mean, you take all the water out, all these biological components are just getting just busted apart. And that sounds pretty nasty, and it is, but obviously they can repair these injuries, which of course is amazing in and of itself. But the broken DNA, before it gets repaired, actually opens an amazing opportunity for these creatures to insert other DNA between the broken parts of the genetic code. And this is maybe how they pull this off. And this DNA can come, this is really cool. The DNA can come from anything that's in the nearby environment. Even if it's partially digested food, they could take any of the DNA that might be nearby, even from this food, incorporate it in their genome, and bam, there you go. Super organism that could digest and survive radiation and do all sorts of amazing stuff. So check this guy out there. I think they're fascinating and they deserve to be on anyone's top five list.
So there is another species that hijacks DNA. Bob, did you hear about this?
Which one?
The Corbicula. It's a clam. These are all male, though. They're genetically male. They're hermaphrodites, so they produce their own sperm and egg and essentially clone themselves. But they also they'll steal the eggs of other species and will incorporate some of the genes. Sometimes they'll incorporate some of the genes from those other species of clams.
So this is wow.
Not as wide-ranging as what you're talking about, but similar. All one sex, reproduced by asexual cloning. In this case, they're hermaphrodites that produce their own egg and sperm, but are viable because they're stealing genetic variation from other species.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I got to look them up.
All right. Well, Evan, now you're going to tell us about another DNA story. Apparently, a researcher claims to have analyzed Bigfoot's DNA.
This is true. It's a company based out of Timpson, Texas. Timpson, eh? And it's called DNA Diagnostics Incorporated, right? And according to their homepage, they are experts in animal and human genetic testing. And the director of DNA Diagnostics is a gal by the name of Melba Ketchum, and she's a veterinarian. Here's a quote from their homepage. All of our testing is of the highest quality, and the staff at DNA Diagnostics Incorporated is eminently qualified to provide superior DNA testing services to our clients. You know, who knows? Maybe they are the best in the business. So let's have a look at their latest press release title, and it's dated November 24th of this year. Bigfoot DNA sequenced in upcoming genetic study. 5-year genome study yields evidence of Homo sapiens / unknown hominin hybrid species in North America. Now, these people claim to be superior DNA testers compared to their, you know, counterparts. So, interesting. The first paragraph of the news release goes like this. A team of scientists can verify that their 5-year-long DNA study, currently under peer review, confirms the existence of a novel hominin hybrid species, commonly called a Bigfoot or Sasquatch, living in North America. Researchers' extensive DNA sequencing suggests that the legendary Sasquatch is a human relative that arose approximately 15,000 years ago as a hybrid cross of modern Homo sapien with an unknown primate species.
Mm-hmm. So where did they get the DNA?
Well, because they haven't published the paper, we don't have a lot of details about it. What happened was one of the collaborators, a Russian researcher called Igor Burtsev, I think jumped the gun and published on his Facebook page the results of this study, forcing Ketchum to then release a press release confirming the rumor that this guy spread on his Facebook page. So it's definitely premature to announce results like this before it's even gone through peer review and been published.
I've come up with a title for this phenomenon because we've seen this several times before in the past, and we've talked about it in instances on the show. And I'm calling it premature press release emissions. And that's where scientists, for whatever reason, cannot control themselves or comport themselves in a professional manner. They have to get their information out before it's peer reviewed, or before any critical analysis by their peers can be conducted.
It's a Pons and Fleischmann maneuver. Cold fusion thing. Right. Yeah.
But I mean, like, now, this is so obviously dumb.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I have trouble even believing that this person has access to a peer-reviewed journal. Like, who cares if they rushed this press release out? It's obviously stupid. Like, Bigfoot doesn't exist. How can you sequence the DNA of something that's not been found to exist?
Well,
that's like saying
they
sequenced the DNA of a unicorn. Found that it was mostly horse. Like,
Rebecca,
where did they get
here's
it?
The next part. I'm
very confused here.
Mostly horse.
Their study has sequenced 20 whole mitochondrial genomes and utilized next generation sequencing, which is, I guess, from Star Trek, to obtain 3 whole nuclear genomes from purported Sasquatch samples.
That's it. Purported Sasquatch samples.
Now, what more do you need than that, Rebecca?
Oh,
your
quite a bit.
Getting us nowhere here. The genome sequencing shows that, I'm continuing in their quote here, the genome sequencing shows that Sasquatch mitochondrial DNA is identical to modern Homo sapiens, but the Sasquatch nuclear DNA is a novel unknown hominin related to Homo sapiens and other primate species.
Mm-hmm. This is how I make sense of this. They have hair samples. Hair samples, as we learned recently, while they do not contain any nuclear material, may retain mitochondria, and so you can get mitochondrial DNA from the hair. So they sequenced mitochondrial DNA from hair samples purported to be from Sasquatch, and they found that they were 100% modern-day humans. Mm-hmm. It's human
right.
freaking hair.
Yeah.
Human hair.
Yes. They have some other samples, purported Sasquatch samples, from which they got nuclear DNA. I'd like to know what they are, but they didn't say that in the press release, and we'll have to wait for the paper, I guess.
Yep.
We should say, Evan spent the day trying to make contact with Dr. Ketchum and were unsuccessful in securing her for an interview. Is that
much like the Bigfoot?
Yep. Much like the Bigfoot.
She is unable to be found.
Elusive.
As elusive as the Bigfoot. So there they found human DNA. And some unidentifiable snippets of DNA. They're concluding from that this is a hybrid between a human and some unknown primate.
It's a hybrid.
I mean,
it's a hybrid.
That is,
as opposed to saying we have more human DNA and some kind of contaminant.
Yeah.
Right.
Or
right.
unknown
contaminant.
Because
unknown
they're
thinging, you know.
They're working to a conclusion.
What are the odds
Steve?
Of that?
They've made up their mind what the conclusion's going to be, and they're working towards that conclusion.
Yeah, so this is anomaly hunting followed by retrofitting into the desired conclusion. Now, the fact that it's what they're finding is modern day human DNA, right, is very telling. They're not finding DNA that is compatible with Neanderthal DNA or DNA from human ancestors from a couple of million years ago. They said, oh, the hybridization must have occurred less than 15,000 years ago, which is just another way of saying it's modern human DNA. But then, so let's look at that claim. So 15,000 years ago, some unknown primate species mated with modern humans and generated a self-sustaining population of big feet.
I'm sorry, Steve, but the plural of Bigfoot is Bigfoot.
Yeah. I like Bigfoot.
Right, plural.
Steve, a sustainable population, Steve, how many individuals would you need? Isn't it something close to 1,000?
Yeah, 2,000 is the number. To really have good odds of sustaining a population is 2,000. But you can't.
Maybe that's what's happened here, though.
It's possible for a few individuals to generate a population.
Maybe they've sustained the population by mating with humans, and that's why it looks like hybrid DNA, because it is actually a pure Bigfoot that has bred with a human to stay alive recently.
That would mean that the Bigfoot actually raped a human woman, because there's no way anyone is having sex with a Bigfoot.
Actually, that's not true.
They unidentified hominin.
That's not true because there was a man who wrote a memoir about his time in the 70s in a cabin in Pennsylvania with Bigfoot, and Bigfoot was very sexual, and the man seemed to be okay with it.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Although, if you take it at face value, this is a male, whatever, primate with a female human, because the mitochondrial DNA comes from the female line, and that's purely human. But the thing is, a primate would not be able to mate with a human and produce fertile young, and therefore, again, a population, a self-sustaining population.
That's the biggest leap of the whole story, in my opinion, is, you know, how do you get to
what
that?
We have where, is, you know, human DNA plus anomalies. That's it. We do not have evidence of a new primate species or a hybrid between a human and some new primate species. That's all pure fanciful speculation. This also reminds me of the Starchild Project. Are you aware of this, guys? The Starchild Project.
Lloyd Pye.
Yeah, Lloyd, the apparent, you know, human-alien hybrid where they analyzed the DNA and they found human DNA plus some anomalies. Same exact thing. Well, the only thing that we know of that they're really finding is human DNA. And then they have to come up with this, you know, hybrid hypothesis. And it doesn't even really make, it even makes less sense with the alien stuff because of what they specifically found.
So this anomalous nuclear DNA, I mean, that's the crux of it right there. All they could say is what? It's not hominid. But it's DNA. It's nuclear DNA, and they just don't know what it is yet.
Some sequences are human. Some sequences are unknown.
Unknown. Guess what they'll turn out to be, I wonder. But hey, this is a superior DNA testing company, folks. Well, you know, you can't question them. Or forbid that they go out and they ask another laboratory to verify what they've got, or wait to do a press release until you have results that can either confirm or go against what it is you're proposing.
But why would you wait?
They don't wait.
Well, of course they're not waiting, because Bigfoot doesn't exist.
Now, she concluded in her press release, she writes at the end, "Government at all levels must recognize them as an indigenous people and immediately protect their human and constitutional rights against those who would see in their physical and cultural differences a license to hunt, trap, or kill them."
What?
Wow, talk about jumping a gun.
Oh my goodness.
I love that.
We should start creating
laws to protect.
Yeah, let's
spend governmental time and resources on creatures that don't exist.
That's amazing.
Statutes, laws, regulations, and funding. We need more funding. Perhaps that is what this is.
So this is evidence for nothing, but it does, you know, raise the question of, well, what would DNA evidence of a novel primate species look like? You know, I would imagine that it would, if you sequenced, you know, human, gorilla, chimpanzee, orangutan, whatever, you know, you create a genetic map orangutan. Of the evolutionary relationship among these various primates, these apes, and maybe even with other primates, and it would fit in there somehow. You know, you would see that it shares mutations with some but not others, and you could fit it into the genetic
tree
somewhere.
Yeah.
But we're not seeing any kind of analysis like that, just pure modern human and anomalies. No mapping of any, you know, new primate species fitting into the primary bush.
Steve, Dr. Ketchum has spoken to the peer review process before in prior interviews, and I'll quote her here. "The peer review will happen unless we get biased people that refuse to pass it for selfish reasons, or if we have some conspiracy theory going on that it's prevented."
Oh, wait, what? Boy, so she's already calling her crazy conspiracy theory she hasn't invented yet a conspiracy theory? Like,
I actually pulled that quote from a prior interview from 2010, actually, for the record. It's from an interview from 2010 from another set of DNA that she's analyzed in the past. She's analyzed lots of things that people basically use her as the catch-all. You got some DNA, throw it to Dr. Ketchum because she'll happily analyze it and, you know, tell you whatever you want to know about it in her own little pro Sasquatch, it definitely exists in my heart world. There you go.
Doesn't it dishearten them in any way? They don't have a corpse. They don't have a one in a zoo. Like, there is no proof whatsoever. Like, they don't have anything.
They
will not stop this press release,
Jay. That's what they're going for. I mean, genetic evidence would be compelling.
Jay, these creatures are shy and brilliant, apparently, and that's how they evade capture or detection in any way. And that's not special pleading. All right. Let's move on. Let's move on. Just very quickly, some interesting dwarf planet news. The dwarf planet Maki Maki. You guys familiar with the dwarf planets, right?
Well, I know Maki. I don't know Maki Maki.
Can you name all five of them?
Ceres. Eris.
Well, you got to name an order from closest to farthest from the sun.
Okay, new instructions. Man, that's great. Thanks, Steve.
Moving the goalposts.
Yeah, right.
If I told you to name the planets, would you go Mercury, Jupiter, Mars?
Maybe. No.
Ceres, Pluto, Maki Maki, Haumea, Eris are the five dwarfs.
What do you want, a cookie?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Want a Maki Maki or cookie?
Scooby snack?
So recently, astronomers were able to learn a lot more about Maki Maki because it passed in front of a star. They trained a lot of telescopes on the small dwarf planet and were able to learn some new things. First of all, it does not appear to have any atmosphere at all. We did not know that.
So not a lot of fun to have.
Maybe it once had an atmosphere, but no longer.
It was able to refine, the astronomers were able to refine their measurement. It's not quite spherical, and it's about 1,430 kilometers across in one direction and 1,500 across in the other. Has a density of about 1.7 grams per cubic centimeter, similar to that of Pluto, less than a third that of Earth.
Where'd that unusual name come from?
It's named after the Rapa Nui chief god of fertility. The chief god of the Tangata Manu birdman cult was worshipped in the form of seabirds. Material symbol was a man with a bird's head. I thought it was interesting that the notion that they're sort of waiting for it to pass in front of a star so that they could sort of see light passing past it, you know, through it. And that's a good way to examine the atmosphere. You look at, you know, you do spectroscopy of the light as it passes through the atmosphere. But in this case, it didn't have.
Right.
Yeah. Very cool.
That doesn't mean that it never has an atmosphere. I mean, I believe Pluto, depending on where it is in its orbit, has an atmosphere or
sometimes
not.
It does.
It just it condenses and rains down on the surface when it gets too cold, and then when it gets a little bit warmer, it can become somewhat gaseous again.
Yeah, a lot of these Plutoids or these Kuiper belt objects do have very eccentric orbits.
Kuiper belt.
Kuiper Kuiper belt. Do have very eccentric orbits.
It's like, Kuiper belt, Steve. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's how you correctly pronounce that word. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. All right. So, Evan, you're going to get us caught up on the puzzle from 2 weeks ago.
The puzzle from 2 weeks ago. Three people are interviewing for a job and are given a test. The first person to solve the test gets the job. Each person is given a hat that is either black or red. They must put the hat on and cannot look at the hat or use any method to directly discover its color. The three applicants are then put in the same room, and each is further instructed to raise their hand if at least one of the other two applicants is wearing a black hat. The task is to figure out the color of the hat that they are wearing. One applicant sees that the other two applicants are wearing black hats, and both of them have their arms raised. After a moment, the applicant states that they have solved the puzzle and that they are wearing a black hat. So how did they solve that riddle?
So when I first heard this puzzle, my initial answer was the applicant may have inferred that in order for the test to be fair, that all three of them should be wearing black hats. So strictly from just the point of view of who's raising their hands, that third applicant could have had a red or black hat. That would be consistent with the other two people raising their hand. But then that wouldn't quite be a fair test, would it? Unless they all had the same color hat. But that's not the precise answer to the puzzle. The answer is, although I do think that's a legitimate point, the real answer is, which I came up with next, was that if he did have a red hat, it would be very easy for either of the other two applicants to solve the puzzle and to know for sure that they had a black hat. And if they were able to quickly deduce that they for sure had a black hat, they would have raised their hand and answered the riddle. Because there was a pause, because neither of them could immediately answer, then the third applicant must have had a black hat, because then either of the other two men, from their perspective, could also have either a black or red hat. And therefore, they would not immediately know what the answer was. So the third applicant used the fact that the other applicants did not immediately answer as another piece of information to infer that he had a black hat.
That's cool.
It's a very subtle right clue in there.
Yeah.
That you had to pick up on as far as the order of things.
Plenty of people did pick up on that. The first one to answer was Magnus M. from the message boards.
Magnus.
That's Magnus, man.
How's Lestat?
Magnus. Well, Evan, do you have a new puzzle or who's that noisy for us this week?
Yeah, I've got a noisy for this week. So open your ears and take a listen to this one and let me know what you think. Here we go.
What the hell was that?
Exactly. Who's that noisy? So, info@theskepticsguide.org and sguforums.com. Those are the ways to post your response to us. Let us know your thoughts. Good luck, everyone.
All right. We do have one email this week. This question comes from Jim White from Boston, Massachusetts. And Jim writes, I'm a chemistry and environmental science teacher, and I love, and occasionally use in class, your podcast. Still, my pedantic nature cringes at the free use of the word theory on the podcast. The SGU frequently substitutes the word theory for more appropriate terms, hypothesis, conjecture, or study. A good example of this was the recent news topic on the relationship between asteroid belts and extraterrestrial life. While an interesting study, it could at most be called a hypothesis, but it definitely doesn't have the experimental evidence or depth of explanation to be a theory. Since the SGU sometimes criticizes others' misuse and misinterpretation of the word theory, please be careful. Bob, can you defend yourself?
Yeah, Bob, what's your theory on that?
Yeah, no, I think I agree. I think I agree with him. I think now that I think about it, I probably do throw that word around a little bit more, especially with the cutting edge, you know, this breaking news stuff that comes out now. Often it's not a full-blown theory. They probably can more often be characterized as a hypothesis or a conjecture. I agree with this assessment. Scusi, mille regretti.
But here's the problem is that there are words that have slightly different meanings when used technically versus when used colloquially.
That is true.
And we do mix them together sometimes. I think the real question is it causing confusion?
Yes.
Amongst some, I think it is. Creationists.
But it's one thing to just be using a term colloquially. It's another thing to actually make a point of confusing the colloquial and the technical definition.
Right. But I think that when we're discussing science news and we use the word theory incorrectly, it dilutes the scientific definition of the word for the general audience.
I agree.
I think, you know, we can still use it colloquially, but I don't think we should use it colloquially when we're talking about science news, because it only bolsters the creationist arguments.
Yep. No, I agree. It's hard not to slip it in there because, you know, we're having a conversation. You're not writing and being careful about your word choice. Well, thanks for keeping us straight, Jim. We'll be more careful in the future. We're sitting here now at TAM 2012 with Banachek. Banachek, it's always a pleasure to see you and talk to you.
Always a pleasure to be here.
So you are now in charge of the million-dollar challenge at the JREF. You manage it.
Yes.
Yeah. So how is that going? What are you up to?
It's a lot of work. I mean, a lot more work than I ever thought. You know, originally when DJ approached me, you know, he said, well, it's more like a spokesperson kind of role, and, you know, you'll get a few
you
things.
You bought that,
and,
huh?
Yeah, I did.
Sucker.
And the first year, it was just... I just spent so much time with back and forth emails, and most of it with people who were never going to apply.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I'm a performer, and, you know, I kind of warned you guys that I'm a performer, and I travel, and I just don't have time for this. So luckily now it's at the point where everything goes to the main office. They take a look at everything. They take a look at the applications. And then only finally when a person has really properly filled out the application, they have everything that goes with it, does it come to me at that point. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I have to find resources to help me out to follow through the protocol.
Now, how many people actually do fill out the application properly?
That's really hard to say. I mean, it really is, because for me also, I'm not getting those applications until they're filled out. So I don't know how many fall by the wayside. I do know that in the beginning, I would get a lot of things if people would just send something on the back of a postcard. Okay, send me my $1 million.
And we should say, I know our audience almost, probably most of them know this, but this is a offer of $1 million. If you can prove a paranormal,
well, it's not
ability.
Proving, no, because it is never. It really is not proof.
Or demonstrate, I mean, to
if
you, under sufficient
if you can demonstrate
methods,
exactly, yeah. You can demonstrate a paranormal ability under proper observable conditions. Now, having said that, though, I truly believe, and this is me, okay, and I think the JREF is pretty much behind that too. If somebody was to pass and was to win the $1 million, it doesn't prove that they have psychic powers. I mean, it certainly doesn't prove that, because that's not the way that science works.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What would happen? Because people win the lottery. I mean, really. Pretty much our odds come to close to 1 in a million in mm-hmm. order for somebody to pass the preliminary and to pass the formal test, because there's two stages to it.
Right.
If they pass both of those, that just simply means they pass 1 in a million. It doesn't mean they're psychic. People win the lottery all the time. Not a lot of people win the lottery, but there are enough that win the lottery. So it could happen. And it also means that just because they fail doesn't mean that they're not psychic. It may indicate more than likely they're not, but it does not mean that they're not psychic. So what we have is $1 million. I mean, we're not an investigator. A gative group, really, although they're, you know, on the fringe sometimes we do some investigations, but we're certainly not set up to do research, and as a nonprofit we're not set up to do research, so we can't do research anyway. And
yeah.
Sometimes claims do come in where they look and you go, you know, wow, this will take 6 months to do, and now this is research. And we get some claims where it's basically they want us to do the research for them, and it's like, mm-hmm. well, we're not a research facility, you know, go to a research facility if that's what you want to do.
So
right.
Why are we doing it? What's the purpose of the $1 million challenge?
I think, for me personally, why do I do it? And I think for Randy as well, he would love to see something that is truly psychic. I mean, that's not the main reason, of course. The main reason is to educate people about this type of phenomena and how much of it is just pseudoscience.
Mm. Yeah, it's an educational tool.
It's a great way to
yeah.
demonstrate it. And quite often we come across claims, and you know, and so many of these people are self-deceived as well. So
yeah.
we can actually teach using this.
Yeah, I mean, that's been our experience, that
yep.
most people who are doing this are self-deceived, I think.
Yeah.
It's kind of a self-selective process. If you were a con artist, you probably would figure, I'm probably not going to get away with my shenanigans with these guys, but if you really think you have
right.
the power, then you'll want to go for it.
Yeah, it's one of those reasons I think now, especially with myself, Randy, and Jamie and Swiss, and a lot of magicians really involved that could detect the phenomena that's out there, and being up on all the new stuff that's out there, it would be almost foolish for a magician to come in and try to fool us
mm-hmm.
With a trick. So the people we get, the majority of people we get, I think they're pretty earnest about what
yeah.
they're going to do. Otherwise, they wouldn't show up.
So what else are you working on?
Quite a few things. The one big thing I've been working on is a brand new stage show. I've done the same stage show for about 30 years now. And the verbiage, everything is just kind of ingrained in my brain and everything. And so now what we've done is I've got a writer who did Todd Robbins' show, which
mm-hmm.
Play Dead, which they did a showing of that, a video showing that last night. And he also did the Mythbusters life tour, and he's done a whole bunch of things like that. And he's always wanted to do something with me. We did do something a while back, which was called Hoodwink, and it was myself, a professional pickpocket, and Todd Robbins was in the show, and a guy by the name of Richard Turner, who's a card cheat. And I would walk Richard out. He would do the three-card money, and he did very, very well. And he would do multiple ways of cheating people, and he would cheat them and give them money up front and then win all his money back.
Mm.
And then we would reveal that he was blind, and he is blind. So he's
wow.
a blind
mm.
card cheat, and people thought that was part of the con, that we were conning them that he was blind, but he really is blind. That's
yeah.
the thing.
Wow.
But the interesting thing is, it was all about how you con people, but in reality, we were conning the entire audience through the whole show.
Yeah.
And it would start out where... we would bring a woman up, and we would use her phone number to give her a psychic reading. And then afterwards, we'd crumple up the number, throw it off to the side, and we'd say, we don't need that anymore. And then we'd continue with the show about cons and everything else. And then almost towards the end of the show, we would ask the lady, where are you? Would you stand up? And said, now, we're going to reveal a few things about you. If you feel uncomfortable at any point, just let us know. We want to introduce you to a couple of our friends. And screen comes up, and there's a couple of our hacker friends. And they would be there, and then we'd say something like, our hacker friends have been very busy throughout the show trying to find things out as a result of your phone number. For instance, they came up with this picture. She says, oh, my God, that's my kitchen. You know, I say, yeah, it is
wow.
your kitchen.
Hmm.
She said, but it doesn't look like that anymore. And would stop her and say, yeah, you did a remodeling, you know, and it cost you X amount of dollars. By the way, keep in mind, anytime you want to stop, you can say stop. And while we did that, we took a look at Facebook, and we found this out, and blah, blah, blah. And, oh, you know, by the way, you know, getting your credit card numbers is extremely difficult if you go to the doctor. But, yeah, but when you go to, you know, the vet and you have two dogs, that's how we found those on Facebook and your local vet, and we found out that your last four digits of your Visa card is this.
Wow.
Is that right? You say yes, and then they usually stop us at the point when we get to some sort of dating, online dating or something like that, and we'd say stop, and we'd stop at that point. And then we would say, now the rest of the audience, you guys wouldn't fall for this, would you? And no, they wouldn't. Everybody's thinking they wouldn't. We say, Montana, come on down. And Montana comes down. Now this girl comes down and she's dressed all sexy, whereas earlier she wasn't dressed quite so sexy. But they realize this is the girl before the show that was out in the lobby with a clipboard, mm-hmm. letting people win a free iPod, and they were giving us their phone number, their address, the best time to call them, you know, when they're at home, basically, and when they're not home, and you just hear a collective. And you may have to bleep this out, but it's, oh, you know, yeah, that's yeah, what it yeah, was. Yeah, so it was like, yeah, you just hear that. You hear everybody. Because they just realized they've given us more information than what she gave us. And we got standing ovations. Yeah. And they bring that back up again. They want to do it in January in Detroit. We have a run with that. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do it just yet because of the new theater show that I'm doing, which is I come out the entire first half as if I'm genuine, which was interesting because I really do tend to mess with people's emotions. But then when we get to the halftime mark, before we go to break, I say now, and it's all about telepathy, and it's all about what people have said telepathy, explanations for telepathy through the years. Mm-hmm. That it's, that it's radio waves that our brains, you know, create, you know, which Einstein believed. I wrote the foreword to a book by Upton Sinclair, mm-hmm. And they believe that our minds produce radio waves that other people could pick up. Some people were better than others, and I do a little demonstration with that in the show. Going all the way to like spirit whisperings where they believe that spirits were all around us and they would pluck a thought out of one person's head and they would whisper it into somebody else's head and people mm-hmm. truly believe that. And culminating in me doing a spirit cabinet and then I get to the point where I say, so what is telepathy? Well, is it this? Is it this? Is it this? Well, I think I know what it is and I think it's something else completely different. I will tell you what I believe it is when we come back from the break. We come back from the break and I say, well, I assume that during the break you debated amongst yourselves. You solved what over 100 years of science could not. What is telepathy? Mm-hmm. In this day and age, people think they can have a Chinese menu of beliefs. They can have they want to have their religion, and they take a sprinkling of the X-Files on top and a dose of fortune telling. And I go through this whole thing. I say, but I promise to tell you what I believe telepathy is. And I say, well, this is what they say telepathy is, and there's a host of fakes and frauds through the years, blah, 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 you know, that would have you believe that. They make a living having you convinced that that is true. But what do I believe it is? I believe it's nothing more than magic. It's a subset of magic. It's entertainment. And what makes me able to say this so bluntly, and then I come out and I start talking about my history, my life, how, you know, I listened to Uri Geller when I was a little kid and I believed I could bend a pin, and then how I read the amazing Randy's book back in the day, you know, The Magic of Uri Geller, which is now the truth about Uri Geller, and the truth, as Randy put it, was that Geller was nothing more than a magician posing as a psychic, and how I became angry reading that book because all the adults around me had believed, and so I had believed, and I learned a valuable lesson. And then I go about how I was abandoned, and I go through my entire life story, so it becomes very, very personal. But this is now an actual show, whereas before my show was pretty much me do an effect and blow your mind, me do another effect, blow your mind, and do another effect, blow your mind. In this case, there's a purpose to this story.
Right.
So it's exciting for me to do it, but it's also scary because it's 2 hours of verbiage that I've never done before. And when we did it up in Toronto, it was, and that's kind of like my workshop, I had like 4 days to work on everything, and including 3 brand new effects that I've never, ever done before. So it was scary, but we walked away, and it was, I think it's, we got fantastic reviews. Yeah,
I can see how an audience can relate to that personal, that interpersonal story much more when you frame it in that regard.
For me, it was always interesting because I hate really talking necessarily, even though it may not seem like it, about myself. I'm very open about my life with people. I don't hide anything. But in this case, the only thing some of the reviews said, they said they love this. You know, it's a smart show. It's a smart magic show that they've wanted, and blah blah blah. And there's all these great quotes. But the one thing they said, you know, we wish there was more about Banachek's personal life, you know. So, and I was like, wow, really? You find that entertaining? I thought the magic was the entertaining aspect of it. So, yeah.
See, but leaving them wanting more, I think that's a big key.
I think that's a big key, but yeah, the reviewers don't see it that way.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that, though. I mean, once you open up the personal door a little bit, and you give them a tiny bit, you know, you're an interesting guy. you know, and you're very charismatic, so I can understand people just wanting to get to understand you a little bit better. You know, plus you are mysterious. I mean, I've seen your stage show. I saw it here at TAMP 5, I think it was. And or TAMP 6.
There's one where I did all of it, and there was one couple where I've done hints of it, so maybe. Yeah.
I saw a big one. I saw it. It was quite a while. It was fantastic.
Awesome. Yeah,
it was
great. My gosh.
You were such an interesting character because you're very much a brick wall. You know, you're not revealing much about yourself, and that makes it more interesting. So yeah. I could even see if you give a little bit, I bet people are really like, oh, well, who is this guy?
Yeah. It was eye-opening for me to see that people would want to know about me as the individual as a rather than just the performer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us, Benjamin. Always a pleasure.
Always fun. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I learned so much from you guys.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts.
Every week, Steve does a science or fiction thing, and this week he was way too lazy and couldn't do it, so he threw it on me, and I really don't like doing this anymore. It just takes way too much time, and it's tough.
Wow.
It's tough, and I could really appreciate, and I really do appreciate what Steve does every week, because to do this well takes a serious amount of time, something that I just did not.
All right, stop complaining.
Have enough
and get
up
on
to. All right, all right.
It's called
but his complaint turned into a compliment. So.
Yeah, I know.
It did. So,
sort
yeah,
of, yeah.
So,
it's called
right,
a backhanded compliment.
All right, guys. Number one, a recent study shows that exposing the unborn and very young to traffic pollution can more than double the autism risk. Number two, to get the best look at a person's face, people focus first on mouths. Number three, writing negative thoughts down and then throwing them away helps people not to think of them. Okay, so Jay, I'm going to say you go first.
So the first one about the exposing young people and unborn people to traffic pollution can more than double their autism risk. So, Bob, if they're unborn, you're saying that the mother is breathing in the pollution? Just don't know about that. I don't know if autism is environmental, and that's the big question. It's interesting, though. Next one is to get the best look at a person's face, people focus on their mouths. Well, there's a lot of features on the human face that you can instantly recognize somebody by, and the mouth is definitely one of them. I mean, you could just look at pictures of famous people's mouths and recognize them. And also, of course, the eyes. I don't know. There is something about somebody's mouth that is amazingly recognizable, maybe even more so than their eyes. So I'm going to think that one is true. And the last one about writing negative thoughts down and then throwing them away helps people not to think about them. I thought that writing them down was good. I'd never heard about the throwing away thing. So it's between this one and the pollution one. And I'm going to go with this one as the fake, the one about writing things down and throwing it away. That's the fake.
Okay. Rebecca, what about you?
You know, a recent study shows that exposing the unborn and very young to traffic pollution can more than double the autism risk. Here's my problem with that. I can believe that there is a study showing a correlation between exposure to traffic pollution and autism, but I have trouble believing that there's a study that shows that exposing them to traffic pollution can definitely more than double their risk. The idea of throwing away negative thoughts that you've written down helping, that makes sense. I think I've seen other studies that have shown that. We've talked about studies like that. I forget the word for it. Steve will remember.
I'm sure embodied cognition.
That's the one. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I can believe that. The second one's weird. To get the best look at a person's face, people focus first on mouths. That's weird because it doesn't even mention a study. It's just a thing. And I don't know. Why are they trying to get the best look of a person's face? Like to remember it, to just to size someone up. Like there's a lot of detail missing there. So I don't know. I guess I'm going to go with that one because I feel like generally people would focus on eyes first. That's really weird and generic. So I'm going to go with that one.
Okay, Evan.
The unborn and traffic pollution. Doubling the autism risk. Wow. So I've read in the past that environment is being studied as you know, one of the possible causes or contributors for autism, and it's not bunk, it's not crap. Apparently there seems to be something there, but I don't know about double the autism risk. I hadn't seen that or recall reading that at all in the past, that could be that big a risk. I think double's pretty significant. The next one, about the person's face and focusing on the mouth first. So when I look at a person's face, and I've taken note of this before, I do look at their mouth first, and then I look at other features on their face. I don't know why. I think maybe if I'm having a conversation with a person, I know people who have a hard time hearing or either hearing impaired or something, they will look at the mouth in order to get a better sense on what people are saying. I'm thinking this one might be the fiction because of that. If you're going to focus on a person's mouth, it might help you hear exactly what people are saying as opposed to getting the best look at the person. The last one about writing negative thoughts down and throwing them away to helps people not think of them. There are other similar mental exercises like this. I think it's reported that they do work, or people claim that they help them with reminders and other things. So I'm not at all really surprised about that. It's a little odd, but not all that surprising. So it comes down to autism risk doubled or people's focus on the mouths first. I'll say people's focus first on the mouths to get a best look at the person's face. I'll say that one's fiction. I think instead of looking at the person's face, it has to do with comprehending the words they're saying.
Okay, Steve. All right, well, good job this week, Bob. I think these are all good. Let me take this in reverse order. The writing negative thoughts down and then throwing them away. It's that kind of symbolic thing that, you know, I think we see all the time in psychological studies. Again, you can sort of make sense either way out of all of these items, which is why they're good. You could say, well, writing it down may actually reinforce the memory of things. But, okay, I'd believe that, you know, the study was done that showed that, you know, the symbolism of throwing it away helps people deal with it, sure. The second one, to get the best look at a person's face, that's ambiguous. The best look based upon what? On what criterion, what goal? The best look to recognize them, to remember them, to read their emotions. I mean, what's the specific outcome here? I don't know. That one might be real. I know for me, I look at the mouth first when I'm trying to recognize somebody. And that's my best chance of recognizing a face, is when I focus on the mouth. I wouldn't doubt that more people look at the eyes first. You could make sense of that as well. So that may be what Bob switched to make that the fiction. But I think that one's plausible. The first one, now there have been studies looking at patterns of autism compared to, say, propinquity to coal emitting factories, you know, like power plants, coal burning power plants. The notion being that being closer to highways or being closer to coal burning plants increases exposure to some toxin in the environment, and environmental exposure causes or increases the risk of autism. So I know those studies have been done. They're largely crap. It kind of depends on who did this study. You know, is this somebody who's really trying to push the environmental autism link? Or was this by a more responsible and objective scientist who, you know, is looking at the data more reasonably? Because I think those studies which have purported to show links like that are very, you know, just very poorly done, and the data is preliminary and really dirty and problematic. So I don't know. Again, I could believe that somebody put this study out, because I know there are people out there that are really looking for ways to sort of push this connection. I have not heard about this. Doesn't mean it's not true, but I tend to hear about these kind of studies, so either I missed this one. I mean, again, usually when I have Bob or someone else do science or fiction, it's because I'm too busy to look at a lot of studies. So unfortunately, those are the very weeks where I could miss something like this. But I think I'm going to go with the autism one as the fiction, partly because I didn't hear about it, you know, partly because I think the more than doubling is a bit much, even for the environmental believers. Not impossible, but I think I'm just going to say that one's a fiction.
Okay, got a nice split here. Steve takes the autism one. Rebecca and Evan have the focusing on mouths. And Jay has the negative thoughts, throwing away negative thoughts. So you don't all agree on anything. So I will start. I'll just take them in order. Our recent study shows that exposing the unborn and very young to traffic pollution can more than double the autism risk. And that is science.
Got Steve. Good job.
This is a study from USC and the University of California that the study title was Traffic-Related Air Pollution, Particulate Matter, and Autism. And it shows that the exposure to air pollution related to traffic during pregnancy and the first year of life is definitely, well, seems to be tightly associated with more than twofold rise in autism. The study participants are the first that looked very closely at the pollution found near roads and then combining that data with the regional air quality measurements. And they also looked at interesting details that seemed pretty granular to me. They looked at how far people were from the road, how busy the roads were, even which way the wind was blowing. So they tried to look at a lot of details and pull it all together. They examined data on about almost 280 autism cases, and they had about 245 control subjects. But in addition, they also found that exposure to two things can also increase the risk. One was pollution consisting of nitrogen dioxide, and the other one was small particles less than 2.5 and 10 microns in diameter. Both of those were also related, even if the mother did not live near a busy road. So this, according to the principal investigator, Heather Volk, she said that this work has broad potential public health implications, which it obviously would if they really nail this and of course, replicate it like any good scientific study should be. So that one, I thought that was interesting. And let's see, go to number two, the first place people look when assess to get the best look at a person's face, people focus first on mouths. That one is fiction. Good job, ooh, Rebecca and Evan. Good job.
Is it for
that
the reason
one,
I think?
This one was kind of weird. I tried to, well, you'll see. Let me explain what was going on here, and I'll explain how it was, why it was kind of worded that way.
All right.
The researchers used an eye tracker and had participants look at 100 photos, and wherever they focused, they were able to, using this eye tracker, they were able to focus where they looked, but not just where they looked, but where they looked initially. The first split second that you look at a person and try to assess them, it's like 250 milliseconds. If they averaged out, it's weird because all people kind of focused right around the bridge of the nose. That's where people looked. You know, it's close to the eyes, but if you look at the average dot, it's pretty much right under the eyes, right in the middle, right on the bridge of your nose. That's where their gaze pretty much always goes. And the key thing here though is that these people trying to determine a person's identity, gender, and their emotional state. So those are the three key things when people were trying to determine that. This is where they looked, which I think is pretty much almost every time you're looking at somebody, you want to identify their identity. Do I know them or not? And then what's their gender and what's their emotional state? That pretty much covers a lot of the times you're going to be looking at somebody, I think. But I didn't want to really just put that into my,
right,
you know, my news item. To say to you guys, I didn't want to throw in all this extra detail of the identity, gender, and emotional state. So I used one of the titles in the news item itself. They put it this way: to get the best look at a person's face, look just below the eyes. So I thought that was a sufficient way to phrase it, to get a best look at a person's face. Because in a sense, that's really what it is. To get
but
this
that's
best
really
look.
Not what that's not really what it is, though. I mean, they haven't determined. By the sound of it, they haven't determined that that's the best place to look. They've just determined that that's where people look.
Determining where people look was the second part of what they did. They actually went through a lot of computations and a lot of math and a lot of algorithms and heuristics to determine and predict what is the best place, based on all these variables, what is the best place that people should look in order to very quickly, which of course would be advantageous evolutionarily, to very quickly determine these key things about people: identity, their emotion, and their gender. And they determined that they're right there under the eyes is the optimal place to look. And that's because the reason why that's so is because it allows people to read information from as many features of the face as possible.
Well, I was not right, but that's all right.
What?
My premise was not correct.
Oh, yes. Way off. But you got it right, so it doesn't matter.
Well.
Okay,
the
third one.
That's the beautiful part of this game.
Writing negative thoughts down and then throwing them away helps people not to think of them. That one is, of course, science. This one was interesting as well. Yeah, embodied cognition, if you're familiar with that, it would kind of make this a bit of a no-brainer. Maybe I could have phrased this even more differently to make it tougher. But this one is fascinating as well. So, in essence, how we treat the physical manifestation of thoughts actually seems to make a difference to how we feel about those thoughts. There are some forms of psychological therapy that use a variation of this concept. They try to get a patient to dispose of their negative thoughts and feelings. And I believe, as far as I could tell, this is the first study that actually validates that approach. One experiment had about 284 students, and they had them write something negative or positive about something that most people believe is good. And one of the examples they used is a Mediterranean diet. People generally believe that this type of diet is definitely healthful and beneficial, and people who live a lot of lives on it generally are healthy and live a long time. They asked some of the participants to write down their thoughts and throw the written thoughts away. Some of them left them. They had them put them on their desk. And the third group of people, they told them to put it in their pocket or their wallet, on their person, essentially. And all these study participants were asked to rate their attitudes towards the Mediterranean diet and their intentions to use the diet for themselves. And as you might guess at this point, is that those who threw the paper away were less influenced by their thoughts than those who kept it on their desks. And those that kept it on their desk were less influenced than those that kept it on their person. And this study was done in three different ways, and it's pretty much what happened when they did each experiment. They did this is interesting as well. They did a similar experiment with a computer. They had them write it on the computer and then either put it in the recycle bin or put it onto some sort of permanent hard storage, and it was the same result. If you put it in the recycle bin, you were less influenced by those thoughts than people who had saved it. And then they took another step, which I think is crucial. They had them imagine this entirely in their mind. They said, think about doing this. And when they did that, what do you guys think happened?
I gave up.
No effect.
No effect at all. No effect, which I think really validates this idea. Good work, guys, yeah. Especially Evan and Rebecca.
Good job, Bob. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote by someone that we all love, Richard Feynman. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong. I have approximate answers and possible beliefs and different degrees of uncertainty about different things, but I am not absolutely sure of anything, and there are many things I don't know anything about, such as whether it means anything to ask why we're here. I don't have to know an answer. I don't feel frightened not knowing things by being lost in a mysterious universe without any purpose, which is the way it really is as far as I can tell.
Awesome.
Very nice.
Wow. Richard Feynman!
Well, before we go, we have a couple of announcements. That it's time once again to get ready for the SGU year-end wrap-up episode.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Another year?
Extravaganza.
And
that's right.
We need the help of our listeners for this. So we have a post on the forums. We'll have the link in the show notes where we would like you to send in your nominations for the best episode, best guest or interview, funniest moment, best who's that noisy, best quote, best science news story of the year, most outrageous illogical statement or pseudoscientific claim, most unexpected scientific discovery, most unbelievable but true science or fiction story, jackass of the year, skeptic of the year, and best bits or lines from each rogue. So send in your nominations. We will read the best ones on the year-end wrap-up show. If you need to look at the list again, it's posted on the forums. We'll have the link in the show notes.
Steve, I have an announcement. Me and George Robb are on the latest episode of Incredulous Podcast, number 16. We had a great time doing it, and please go to mercysideskeptics.org.uk and download the episode.
That's awesome,
Dave. They're fun guys. Also, this is a good time of year to remind our listeners that you can support the SGU in many different ways. You can send us
really,
a donation.
Steve? How can they do that?
You can also make a recurring donation through PayPal. If you go to the store page from the SGU, the skepticsguide.org main page, you will see there the store and support page. From there, you can subscribe to the SGU via PayPal. You can download premium podcasts. You can make one-time donations. And you can go to Skeptical Robot where you can purchase SGU swag. We do appreciate your support. I'll take this opportunity to say thank you to all of our listeners who have supported us in the past. It does help us produce and put out all the content that we do. So please consider paying a visit to our store page and giving us some support. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.